Last week, during Baltimore's riots over the death of Freddie Gray, a video went viral of African-American Baltimore woman Toya Graham hitting and swearing at her son to get him to stop participating. Graham said she did so because she did not want her son to get hurt by police and become another Freddie Gray. She discussed why she did what she did in an interview with CNN's Anderson Cooper.
This thing has gone viral. There's, you know, Oprah Winfrey gave you a call. There's a lot of, you know, there were headlines in the paper saying send in the moms. Why do you think this has made such a big impact?
Because as mothers, you don't see us. You don't see us. You see our kids walking to the bus stop and maybe speaking with somebody that's on the corner, and they already been singled out as thugs, as we have already heard that they are. And at no time is my son a thug.
Reaction has ranged from calling Graham Mom of the Year to saying she should be charged with child abuse. Graham's son told ABC he understands why his mom did what she did.
I understand how much my mother really cared about me, so I just gotta try and do better.
I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up now on 10 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Wednesday, May 6th. We will talk with an author and a mother this hour who says she can relate to Graham's struggle and who says black moms must parent differently from white moms in order to protect their children from a world that is much more dangerous than it is for white children. And we will welcome your thoughts and your questions. What was your reaction to the video of the Baltimore mom? Do you think our guest's philosophy about parenting is right? Are you a parent balancing the same worries as our guest? And what differences do you see between black and white parenting? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Yolanda Galt Cavanis, a parenting journalist, mother of three, writer for publications such as Redbook, Essence, Latina, and Parenting. Her op-ed, What Black Moms Know, appeared in Sunday's New York Times. We have posted a link to the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. She is also the author of the just-released book, Child Please, How Mama's Old School Lessons Helped Me Check Myself Before I Wrecked Myself. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Well, tell us what went through your mind when you first saw the video of Toya Graham hitting her son.
Well, I first saw her spring onto the screen, and my heart just sank because what I felt as a mom was just a very visceral connection to her, because I could see the fear in her eyes. I could see the sadness, and I thought, here's a woman gripped in a tragedy, gripped in a firestorm, in the middle of a war zone, and she's like a mama bear rushing out to protect her child. That's what I saw.
Yeah.
That's what I saw.
And what did you make of the media coverage of that video, at least initially?
I was alarmed, to be honest with you. I was disturbed. I mean, I did not really see it as newsworthy as the media kind of put it up to be. I mean, I did think it was very touching, and I felt like I empathized with her greatly. What saddened me, though, I don't mind. I mean, you know, we're in the media. We know that sometimes you take a story and you run with it, Mom of the Year, and she was obviously displaying sort of that old school type of mothering that we've gotten away from. So I kind of get where that story lie. I was disturbed, though, by the people who said, oh, she should be brought up on charges. How dare she hit her child? No wonder he's violent. She's violent. I mean, I heard some very disturbing things, and she was really reduced to a caricature after a while, you know, of what black moms in the hood do or how they act, or, you know, we made all kinds of assumptions about her. When I think, to be honest, I don't know her, of course, but I think she was just simply responding with adrenaline and doing what she felt she had to do at that moment. I think it's akin to grabbing a toddler and pulling him out of oncoming traffic. And, of course, he's not a toddler. He's a big, overgrown 16-year-old. I have a 16-year-old. And they don't necessarily do what you say when you say. And maybe that was not the best time for her to try to reason or give him a time out or go through her mind and, you know, call up all the research on corporal punishment. She was just instinctively, I thought, doing what she felt she had to do. So it saddened me to hear people disparage her and, you know, reduce her, as I said, to some kind of a caricature. I don't think she was thinking. And it just points to a larger issue in our culture, I think, where everyone is a critic on what moms do, parents in general, dads too. If a child is noisy on a plane or in a restaurant, look at that parent. Look at that parent. Look at this one. This is not the right way. This is not the right way. And it points to the judgment that I actually try to address in child please, because I feel like we're just being assaulted at every angle. And in the older days, when I was growing up, you know, my mom was bringing us up. Anyone on our block, any grown-up on our block could pull us aside and actually spank us if they felt we needed a spanking. I never got one, but from other people, I got them from my mom. No one questioned it, because that was a grown-up's judgment. But, wow, it's really turned around now.
Yeah. You know, I thought at first, my perspective was that a lot of the cheering, though, you know, Mother of the Year, we need more moms like her, was a thought that there wasn't any discipline going on, and they were cheering her for disciplining her son. Yeah. And then I think there was a little bit of reflection when she said, I did this to protect my son.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know what? It's very funny, isn't it? Because we can all look at something, you know, three or four people can look at something and see three or four different things. And I think in the African-American community, and quite honestly, this is what hurt me most, I think in the African-American community, the people who were putting her down were seeing the reaction of the media as a negative. In other words, they were seeing this woman heralded for, again, beating a black boy. Again, a black boy is being beat. You know what I mean? Again, we see a black boy being mishandled and mistreated. And I think that maybe some in the African American community were responding to the fact that she was being lionized. I saw on social media when she was the day that she did several appearances, Anderson Cooper, I think The View, and some other things, we heard her own words after the incident, and people were saying, oh, doesn't she know she's a pawn? They're using her. You know, we all see different things, and I think it points to the fact that in this climate, we're all so hypersensitive and hyper-aware of race and racial stereotypes, and it, to me, begs the need for more conversation, I think. I think we're just so reluctant to talk about race, and when I looked at some of the comments, and maybe I shouldn't have, but when I looked at some of the comments from the New York Times op-ed, it became clear to me that when you talk about race, no matter how you talk about it, there are just going to be people who refuse to have a sane conversation. If race is brought in, it's automatically racist. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, Toya Graham said she was terrified that her son would become another Freddie Gray. She didn't want him to die at the hands of police. And you wrote that this fear was something that has shaped black parenting since the days of slavery. Talk more about that.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Historically, black parents have had to be extremely harsh with their children. If you think back to a plantation, first of all, black moms could never be assured that they would actually be able to keep and raise their children, because a slave master could take them away at any moment, sell them away at any moment. So, you know, you had to pour into that child as much as you could about survival. Not, of course, love. I mean, in whatever way they were able to show love, you know, given the circumstances they lived under of slavery. But you wanted to make sure, and it's just a human need. You wanted to make sure that this being that you brought into the world would survive. So when you talk about things like parenting as we do now, and self-esteem, and happy kids, that's never really been a strong part of a black parent's goal, because we know from slavery and beyond. I mean, my mom grew up in the Jim Crow South, and I remember visiting Mississippi in the 70s when, you know, the Voting Rights Act had passed. You know, I lived up north in Buffalo, New York, and, you know, things seemed okay. I didn't really, you know, as a kid, I didn't really perceive a racism, and things seemed okay to me. And I went down there, and just as a 7-8-year-old kid, the racial tension was so thick. I can remember.
Yeah, let me hold you there, Yolanda. We have a news break. We'll catch up on news, and then we will pick up on this. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Yolanda Galt Cavanis. She is a parenting journalist, a writer, a mother of three. She wrote an op-ed that appeared in the New York Times on Sunday, What Black Moms Know. She is also the author of the just-released book, Child Please, How Mama's Old School Lessons Helped Me Check Myself Before I Wrecked Myself. We welcome your thoughts and your questions for her as we talk about differences in black and white parenting. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We have callers waiting, so let's pick up the conversation with Carl in Madison. Hello, Carl.
Yes, good morning, and what an important topic. As a supervisor of student teachers for an elementary education teacher education program, I've seen young white student teachers go into classrooms, predominant African-American student population, and sometimes with a black teacher, and they may express something like, oh, black parents are so tough on their kids, and reading it at a surface level, it's natural to go with the gut that you were raised by or what you felt, but young African-American children, particularly black boys, face the same challenges every other child faces, but they also face additional challenges. And if you are a parent of a child who is sometimes facing what feels like a war zone, and sometimes the person on the other side of that line is an officer in uniform, as we've seen in Baltimore, your responsibilities as a parent are very fundamental and very real, and the sweet and cute and cuddly is maybe not an option to see your child through. You've got to be real clear and real direct. So sometimes love looks pretty fierce. And I think that for the white parents out there that are thinking, oh, you know, oh, these parents are so harsh on their kids, until you've had the reality that you face that your child may not see adulthood or may be incarcerated for issues far beyond their control, it's really important to dial back how you might parent in that situation to deeply understand the serious crisis these kids are facing and the parents who these young black boys, they revere their mothers because they may be the only person in their lives who cares enough about them to do whatever it takes to see them through.
Yolanda.
Mm-hmm. That was really beautifully put, Carl. I don't know if I could have said any better myself, but I agree with you wholeheartedly. I just want to point out that to people who think this is, you know, unfairly pinned on race, it's not. It's just that, as you say, we have all the responsibilities of any other parent and then some. So it is a delicate balance. I want to add, though, as well, that, you know, when you do see the black boys in this fierce love and attachment a lot of times they have with the moms, it's also because I think most black moms do a phenomenal job of balancing that, you know, that harsh reality with love and tenderness and humor. I mean, I talk about that a lot, especially in my book and just among friends. It's with humor, and it's with, you have to be careful, I think. I have a young son myself. I have an 8-year-old, and You don't want to make your children angry. You don't want to make them bitter. You don't want to make them feel as though they're victims by any stretch. But you do have to sort of just have a subtle tone in your conversation all the time. You know, I've heard people say whenever there's been, you know, recently violence against black boys in the news lately, I've heard it said among African Americans, well, it's important that you have the talk with your child. And it's not really the talk. It's just talking. It's just talking on a regular basis so that, you know, they have an awareness that, you know, you're a great guy and you're a great girl, but, you know, sometimes people may not recognize that, or sometimes someone may see you and think this, even though that's not what you're about, and it's okay, it's not you. You have to have that conversation all the time, and it does add another level to your parenting.
Yeah, and when you mean the talk, when you say the talk, that's the talk about what? How to?
Well, I've heard it said that yeah, you have to have the talk about, for example, if you have a young teenage African American son, when you go out into public, you know, don't do this, don't do this, don't do that. Or if a police officer stops you, well, this you need to say, I think, to any young kid, but don't reach for your pocket. Don't look in the eye. I've heard different things along social media lines about the kinds of things we should be doing as black parents to prepare our, especially our sons, for encounters with the police.
Yeah. You write in Child Please. We don't see our kids as anything akin to fine china, not to be disturbed or broken. In fact, given our druthers, most black parents would choose to break their kids before someone else does. So habits like speaking out of turn, acting out in public, or any action that draws the scrutiny of outsides is to be halted immediately. We fear that if we wait for our kids to simply outgrow such childish, they will suffer at the hands of authority, especially those men in blue. Authority with its billy sticks and handcuffs and black robes has not been kind to us.
And I say that in all seriousness. I think that as I talked about slavery and Jim Crow South, and there's a legacy. There's a legacy. And I know that, you know, to some white Americans, it might seem as that might seem overly harsh, because one might say, oh, but this is 2015. Surely you don't have to, you know, parent like that. Surely you don't have to do that. But, A, I think if you're brought up a certain way, whether or not you intend to or not, there's vestiges of that remain. But, B, you know, we're not post-racial, so you still have to really do that. And I think that when I say we'd rather break them ourselves, quote-unquote, what I'm saying is that when you hear about people in the larger society, the risks of overpraising, for example, I just really, just personally, I can't think of any black home in which that would happen, because if anything, you get the message from a black parent constantly, hold on there, don't get ahead of yourself. Okay, now you're getting too big for your britches. It's always sort of, yes, be black and proud and all that, but keep it in check.
Yeah,
don't get too, you know.
And your mom raised you this way.
Yes, she did. Oh, my gosh, did she ever. Did she ever. I mean, my mom was probably the quintessential. She grew up in Alabama. She grew up four blocks away from the 16th Street church bombings in Birmingham. I, on the flip side, though, I mean, amazingly, and I think this is true for a lot of people, a lot of black women and men from that era, she's not a trace of bitterness, not a trace of bitterness. She never once would say to us or even suggest to us that white people were bad or that we should regard them with any kind of fear or hatred. But she was very, very clear. And some people, if you're a fan of the show Scandal, you saw it with Papa Pope, as we call him. It was very clear that we needed to be twice as good and we had to work twice as hard to get half of what, that's what she would say. You have to work twice as hard, and you have to be twice as good to get half of what a white person would get. That's just what she told us. Yeah. That's how we were raised.
And now how do you do this with your own children?
Well, it's very different now. I mean, I live in a North Jersey suburb, and it's very diverse. And you know, my kids have friends, thankfully, you know, of every color and stripe. We have a wonderful community, as I said, of not just racial diversity, but, you know, sexual orientation. It's really a great community. So it's a trickier dance. It really is. I do small things, and I try to build on those. For example, my youngest is 8. And I recently introduced him, because he loves sports, so I recently introduced him to Jackie Robinson. And, you know, there was a great graphic novel that talks about Jackie Robinson and his struggles. And I kind of thought that was a good entryway. A lot of times in school when people talk about Martin Luther King, they just talk about service. So I didn't really think that from school he was getting enough of what it really has meant to be a black person in this country. So I try to build on that, and then I talk to him about the fact that his grandparents were brought up in the Jim Crow South. You know, like Jackie Robinson, they were treated unfairly. And then I sort of segue into things like, you know, even though it's a new day, some people will still look at you unfairly. You know, it's a little bit of that. Now, my oldest is 16. But my oldest, I will tell her, because, you know, like most 16-year-olds, I don't think it matters what color you are. Mm-hmm. You know, they love their phones, and they want to chill, and they want to, mm-hmm. they don't really want to, you know, do much of anything that would stretch them. And I tell her, you may not like it, but this is your reality. You have to work, and you have to work really hard. I've told her point blank that if she doesn't study, if she doesn't do well in school and, you know, do well in college, we don't have the kind of family that has a safety net for her. I can't call Uncle George, who owns this company. Or, you know, it's different. It's different. And I've had to say to her, quite frankly, your friend Susie, because, you know, also in this town there's a lot of wealth. Your friend Susie, that's not us.
Yeah. Let's go to Todd in Milwaukee next. Hello, Todd.
Hello. I just want to bring something up that I think is really important, and I wish we would cover that, is I don't see it so much as a black or white issue. I really see it more as a poverty issue. And unfortunately, there has not been a lot of upward mobility for blacks to have a black middle class, and that's no fault of theirs. I think that's a societal thing. We have segregation, a lot of stuff going on. But I do know that raising your kids in a lower-income neighborhood is a lot different than raising your kids in a not-so-low-income neighborhood. The challenges and the things that those kids have to face is a lot different. You know, it depends on what neighborhood you live in, what schools they go to, and I think, you know, hats off to those moms that do what they need to do to make sure, you know, especially if they're working two or three jobs to try and make ends meet, and they don't have they're not there all the time, you know, mm-hmm. they have to do what they have to do to make it, to survive. And I think that's a mm-hmm. completely different mode. And I think the problem that we have is we get into this black and white thing, but we forget that it's also a socioeconomic thing, and we need more upward mobility for the black population. And I think as we have more integration, more assimilation, it's not going to become so much a black culture or a white culture. It'll be our culture.
No, no, no.
I would agree with you. I would agree with you, Todd. It is very much a class issue. And I think that's one of the reasons I was so disappointed in the responses from other African Americans when Toya Graham burst onto the screen. You know, we mostly were sitting on our sofas watching the uprising, listening to whatever Anderson Cooper, you know, said and other commentators said. And meanwhile, she's living in it. She has the sirens and the glasses smashing and the windows, but right outside her door. So I would agree to that. On the other hand, though, I do want to point out that even in the black middle class, and it's not growing as fast as we'd like it to, I totally agree with you, there is a black middle class. And even within that, I think one of the things I really wanted to point out in Child Please is that no matter the class, you still have to, as a black parent, prepare your child. Wasn't it with the University of Virginia? I remember across social media, again, I sort of 6 degrees of separation. There was a young man from Chicago who went to prom with an old college friend of mine. You know, he went into this bar to watch a sports event, I guess. It was a sports bar, and I don't know what happened. A bouncer beat him, and was Marley, or I'm forgetting
his
name.
Yeah, I don't remember that one.
And he said, University of Virginia, he said, I'm a student because it was an off-campus event.
Oh, yes.
I'm a student at UVA. And, I mean, not to be harsh, but my grandfather used to say, when you get stopped by the police or you get stopped, he used to put this in the context of Ku Klux Klan, if you get stopped, they're not going to ask you what kind of N-word you are. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're just going to be that N-word to them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I mean, certainly, we hear all sorts of stories about the very well-to-do African-American law professor who is pulled over because
right.
he's driving while black.
Or... Right. So I would agree with a lot of what Todd says. But there's still that caveat, and a lot of this is class. I would agree with that, and I think that one of the reasons my heart really bled for Toya Grahams is I just cannot imagine. I cannot imagine going through what she goes through, and I feel as though I should never complain again about, having a life with three kids and a cozy suburb. I should just never complain.
Todd also mentioned among his many comments that in low income neighborhoods, single moms just don't have the time to
mm-hmm.
parent in the same fashion as middle class or wealthy moms. How much does that have to do with any of this?
You mean in the New York Times piece?
No, Todd mentioned that he thought that that single moms don't have the time to, I think he was implying, spend enough time raising their kids properly.
Well, I'm not sure if he was implying that or not, but what I do see even in our town is that parents who work a lot, and there are parents in my town who are not single and just work a lot. Maybe both parents work two jobs or they do shift work or... whatever the case may be, I think that there is a different set of priorities. I don't know that I would say they don't have time to parent, but I think that they don't have time to coddle. They may not have time to do a lot of the extra things that a middle-class family would do. And, frankly, they probably do have to have their kids, spend time alone more than they would like, or more than we would if we were in a different socioeconomic background. When you're working, and I think Toya Grahams pointed out that she had worked a couple of jobs and now was laid off, but I think that's true.
Yeah, we have just a couple of minutes before a newscast. Didn't you? You wrote in the book that your mom worked, and your grandfather would pick you up from school, or your
mm-hmm.
aunts in the neighborhood would pitch in
mm-hmm.
and help.
Exactly. Blacks have worked for a long time. Even in the middle class, there was not such a leave it to beaver type of existence, and sociologists have shown that. And I think that maybe, and I'm not saying this to disparage white women, and some women have taken it the wrong way. I just think that since there has been that culture of working for so long, there was never a mommy war. No one would, in the black community would think of a mommy war, because every kid on that block was my mom's kid, and I was every kid, every mom on that block was my mom in my mom's absence. There was just this sense of community. Some of that's generational, I know. We've just become a more splintered, transient society. But, my grandfather, extended family members living in the same household with you, that's such a tradition in the black community. And so I think that in some ways, perhaps, black mothers even today may have a tighter support network than white moms who've been, in my estimation, really pitted against one another. I don't think this is something that stems from white women themselves, but I mean, when you have the media telling you on one hand, as women rise to the workforce, oh, daycare makes your child aggressive, oh, you need an expert for this, I think it's a divide and conquer kind of strategy. I really do.
We are talking with Yolanda Galt Cavanis. She is a parenting journalist, author of the new book, Child Please, How Mama's Old School Lessons Helped Me Check Myself Before I Wrecked Myself. We'll talk more after the news. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about the differences between black and white parenting. and welcoming your thoughts and your questions for our guest, Yolanda Galt-Cavanis, who is the author of the just-released book, Child Please, How Mama's Old School Lessons Helped Me Check Myself Before I Wrecked Myself. She's also the author of an op-ed piece that was published Sunday in the New York Times, What Black Moms Know, in which she talked some about the viral video of the Baltimore mom who was seen hitting and swearing at her son to get him to stop participating in the Baltimore riots. So we welcome, again, your thoughts, your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Yolanda, in your op-ed, you write that you feel sorry for the usually white moms who you see panicking over the right way to raise their kids. You say that modern parenting is sometimes treated as an extreme sport. Talk a little more about that. Why do you think this is?
Well, I think it's the case because there's money to be made. I think that in the same ways that, we as women read up on, how to have thin thighs in 30 days and how to, you know, I think we're sort of the prime market of how to do anything better. It's great that we want self-improvement, but I think that the parenting industry has taken advantage of that, to be quite honest, and I think that a lot of the expert tips and a lot of the gadgets and a lot of the things you see that marketers and media come out with are really in effort to sort of pimp our anxieties, you remember when there was My Baby Can Read, or, there's just every year there seems to be one or two more new fangled things that just really usurp maternal instinct. And I think that when you have a population, and it's not all and only white women, but when you have a population that is very busy and very scattered, with demands of work and demands of family, that you have a sort of prime market to take advantage of certain population. I think that's what happens. And nowhere, I think, is a woman's heartstrings or her sensitivity, her vulnerability more wide open than when it comes to her kids. Yeah. So I do feel sorry for those people who have grown up and sort of lost their way. And quite honestly, I almost lost mine too. So that's why I can say that. I did some really stupid things.
You said that you started out parenting in this extreme sport way. What made you stop?
I'd love to say that I just got so wise over time, but what really happened is that I had a third child, and there was a gap in between. My son is 8, and my second daughter is 14, so there's 6 years there, and I realized that I couldn't keep it up and maintain my sanity, and I don't have much, but I do have good sense, as Mama would say. I didn't want to lose that, and there was going to be no way I could keep up this constant piano lessons, soccer, whatever it was that the experts said they needed to make them smart or to make them strong or to make them. I realized, as my mother had quite honestly been telling me the whole time, I realized that I already knew what I needed to know. I didn't need anything on the outside, that if I stopped and thought about it long and hard enough, I could figure it out. And it was best that way, because no one could be an expert on the people I brought into the world. They could be an expert in general, I guess, and of course there's child psychologists and, people like that whose opinions we should value and whose research we should value. But when it comes down to it, you can really only go with your gut. That's all you have.
Yeah, and your mom raised you to, by saying, have good sense, and is that the biggest difference?
She raised me with a whole lot of sayings, to be honest with you, and I didn't realize until I got older how much sense they made. I thought they were just things to say. She would say, for example, sit down and act like you've got some sense. And that meant when we were growing up, just act right. Just stop with the crazy behavior, act like you've got some sense. But what I realized she was saying after I grew up was that she was saying, really, you do have it, so just relax and get it back. Regroup. She would also say, just go someplace and sit down. And I think that in our fast-paced culture, most of us don't do that. We just keep going and going and going. A lot of this stuff we know, but we got it from a book and we got it from a TV show, and we don't have time, so let's keep going. Let's get a blurb or a quip here and go with that, and Oprah said that, and, you know, it's just a whole bunch of sound bites because we're moving so fast that we don't stop to consider the fact that, do I really need to get Mandarin lessons for my kid? Let me really think about this. It's all a lot of knee-jerk stuff, you know what I mean?
Janine in Park River, Michigan is with us. Hi, Janine.
Hi there.
Go ahead with your comment.
Well, I was interested to hear your guest's thoughts on this idea of raising our children, you know, sort of breaking them before the outside world does. And I guess I'm curious on her thoughts of that not being exclusive to the African-American community, that, you know, there are many white families that raise their kids that way too, or maybe should be. you know, I think that's the way I'm raising my kids. You know, the general idea of teaching them respect for authority and, you know, things like that. And I guess I just am curious about, is that really an exclusive thing, or is it more prevalent in the African-American community? And I'll be happy to take comments off the air, on my radio.
Yeah, get it. Yolanda?
I'm really glad you asked that question, because, no, I don't think it's exclusively African-American. When I tell a lot of people, and I have friends in town, as I said, you know, we have a community, and I'm lucky enough to be around people from all different backgrounds, and sometimes my friends will joke and say, are you sure your mama wasn't Jewish, or are you sure she wasn't Italian? Because a lot of it is generational. You know, you have to remember, and I don't know that, you know, it's not really a large part of the New York Times piece, but I wrote a memoir, so my story is my story. It's about my perspective. It's about how I grew up, and it's about my family. But that's just a lens, I think, for the greater society. And I'm hoping, just like you said, that people will understand that there's all kinds of similarities, all kinds. We run the gamut. We're probably actually more alike than we are different. I'm just telling the story from how I grew up, and obviously I'm black, so.
Charles on Facebook says, my vote for best fictional dad has gone to Furious Styles from Boys in the Hood. There is a climactic moment when he confronts his son with the purpose of protecting him, and throughout his parenting is disciplined, rational, and anything but inclined to spoil. But it seems harder to find examples of black mothers that are not comedically stereotyped on TV and in movies. Are there parallel examples of non-comedic literary fictional black mothers that I should share with my kids?
Oh, wow, that's a heavy one, and you're really taking me back to Boys in the Hood. And to be honest with you, if I didn't have a 16-year-old who, you know, and a 14-year-old who sort of kind of delve into that, well, it's history for them, I would have forgotten that. But I remember that guy. I remember that character. Well, I think, though, to answer the question, this gets to one of the reasons I think that I really wanted to say what I wanted to say in that New York Times piece and also in Child Please. It's not just black women.
Oh, did we lose our guest? Uh-oh. We might have to at least try to call her back to get some concluding remarks, as we are only have a few more minutes left in the program. We have been talking with Yolanda Galt-Cavanis. She is the author of the new book, just released, Child Please, How Mama's Old School Lessons Helped Me Check Myself Before I Wrecked Myself. She also has done a number of writings, including an op-ed piece that appeared Sunday in the New York Times, What Black Moms Know. And we have been talking with her about differences between black and white parenting. And we'll get her to give us some concluding remarks as we get her back online. And we have, okay, Yolanda, sorry.
Technical difficulty. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, so one of the, you were saying one of the main reasons that that you wanted to talk about this issue. And that was the main reason?
The main reason is that we, like a lot of groups in society, not just black women, you know, we're spoofed a lot. You see the black woman with her hand on her hip and, you know, the good times and didn't I tell you, you know, and you see that part and it seems funny and it seems entertaining, but it's really very one-dimensional. So what I was trying to show in the book and in the essay was just that there's something behind that. It's not just a matter of trending Twitter topics like, you know, I'll smack you, or it's not that. I think Claire Huxtable was good. I do. I mean, some people might disagree, but I thought she was a positive black mom. And my kids like to watch that. We have tapes and stuff and, you know, the DVDs. They like to watch those. He asked, you know, if there was a fictional black mom who I thought was a good role model, I would say her.
We have just a minute to go. The main takeaway, what do you want us to understand about parenting in black families in 2015?
I want us to understand that it's nuanced, and I want us to understand that although we have the same struggles as the white population, that we have unique struggles, too. We have very unique challenges, and that's changing, and I hope it continues to change. But what I really hope is that we can all learn from each other, because I think that the bit of harshness that we bring to the parenting table should be balanced with some of the indulgences that you see in the greater society. I think both have really good qualities, and let's blend them together and let's learn from each other, sort of mix the old and new.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yolanda Galt-Cavanis, author of Child Please, How Mama's Old School Lessons Helped Me Check Myself Before I Wrecked Myself. Thanks very much to Christy Taylor and to Kayla Blato for producing and directing this program. Join us tomorrow at this time as we talk about the famous Wisconsin craft beer Spotted Cow and a new documentary about the making of Spotted Cow. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.